dining hall that's crowded? People not come home from the weekend? First class was like empty too. It's insane. Any teams have road games today? Any teams, soccer, anything like that? Is there soccer in the spring or is it in the fall? What is track?
Fall.
Fall. Mm-hmm. Right. Brandon, Trevor, and the brothers. So for you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 that came in, I screwed up engage. Your tests are done. They didn't open. So I got to go work on it tonight. So next time I see you, you'll know where you stand. But overall, the grades were good. A couple of people did well. A couple of people didn't. No complaints. Nothing I'm freaking out about. All right. So we're on the road to World War I. Very significant event. And in fact, there are many historians that argued that unlike many of the events that you may study in history, World War I was one of those events that truly changed the flow of human history itself. As we know, there's a lot of politics going on. You had Bismarck trying to protect German unification by creating an alliance system so he could control the relationships amongst all the countries. He was forced out by Kaiser Wilhelm II, who essentially was a bully and who wanted to engage in Weltpolitik, world politic. And in pursuing that type of thuggery, he made a series of mistakes, and we're on the fourth of the four mistakes. The first being he allowed Russia to go away. He didn't renew the reinsurance treaty. Second, he went all in on with Austria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which itself was a mess, telling them basically they could do whatever they wanted in the Balkans. They didn't do anything to stop an alliance forming between the Russians and the French, which of course suddenly gave France an ally, which is something Bismarck did not want. And now Germany's surrounded on two fronts. And lastly, arguably as important as the other three, he managed to scare the bejeebus out of the Brits. How? With a naval policy designed by Tirpitz, based on essentially what's known as the risk factor. Tirpitz told the Kaiser Germany could make a huge navy because England would never use their navy to stop them. Because of the cost. Also, if the British Navy clashed with the German Navy, England's Navy would become weaker. And as a consequence, England would not be able to defend its empire.
So they launched a massive naval construction campaign. And England paid attention. Now, I don't know how the hell to make an analogy with this, but there are points in our lives where sometimes something happens in the morning that impacts the way we make decisions around midday. Maybe we didn't get a good night's sleep, so we're a little agitated. So someone may say something to you that just like kind of triggers you, whereas if you had a good night's sleep, you might have thought a different way and life would have been a little smoother. Well, for England, the idea of Germany building a navy to challenge them was that shock midday. Because England at the time was engaged in a serious crisis. All the way up till around 1900, England believed essentially that it was undefeatable. Yeah, sure, they lost the American War for Independence. But other than that, which occurred even 100 years before, England had been on a win streak. They managed to seize control of India. They managed to beat the living snot out of the Chinese and get those unequal treaties, making spheres of influence, building their imperial economy, doing whatever they wanted in Africa. No one could stop them. Up until an event that occurred in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. An event known as the Boer Wars, which we talked about, if you recall. The Boers, the South Africans, who were descendants of Dutch colonists, rose up and fought two wars for independence. And while England won, they barely won. So as a result, there were people in England basically saying, are we not as strong as we thought? And if we're not as strong as we thought, we could lose our empire. Ironically, at the same time, the Kaiser tried making offers to England to join the Triple Alliance. This was a way to convince the Brits that you don't have to worry about the German navy. But ultimately, the talks would break down. And England would say, yeah, we don't want to be part of that agreement. Because again, think of the realities. The Triple Alliance is a series of three alliances, all aimed at either fighting a war with France or with Russia. And now because of the Russo-French agreement, that war could be a reality. So England didn't want to tie itself to something that could result in a war. So, England carried on. Then the Boxer Rebellion happened. Granted, you had that eight-nation alliance group that managed to suppress the Boxers. But England's thinking with the Boer War, okay, we're not as strong as we thought, and look at what would happen if you had a group of our subjects suddenly rise up and rebel. It could be catastrophic. So England is going through a period of tremendous doubt. So what do? They try seeing if they can build their strength up. Instead of going it alone, England started seriously contemplating, okay, let's see if we can start making localized alliances. For instance, that's one of the reasons why England worked with the Afrikaners when we talked about South Africa. They gave the white Africans basically control over the region. Well, similarly, they would do the same thing in Asia. In 1902, England had become so impressed with Japan and all of their reforms from the Meiji Restoration, as well as the sweeping victory they had in the First Sino-Japanese War, that England realized, okay, Japan is another regional power. If we make an alliance with them, we can use Japan to kind of protect our holdings in China. So we're going to have the Afrikaners protect South Africa. We're going to have the Japanese protect our stuff in China. This is good. Now, FYI, this agreement, similar to the other terms that I showed you. If England or Japan attacks, the other is going to be neutral. But if either are attacked, then the other is going to support.
So in 1902, 1903, England's thinking, okay, we've stabilized things. Until suddenly Japan finds itself in a war.
But not just any war, a war with the Russians. This, diplomatically speaking, was complicated. Because technically, England didn't know what it should do. Because technically, Japan attacked. So should England stay neutral? Well, side note, England at the time was competing with Russia for control over modern Iran, Persia.
So if England was actually to go in and help Japan, maybe they could weaken Russia, and thus maybe they could get more ground in Persia. But hold the phone. Now Russia has an ally. France. If England goes in and attacks Russia to increase its position in Persia, that might allow the French in Southeast Asia and Vietnam to attack India or to attack China. So suddenly we have the threat of a war that could escalate, that could be crippling. Well, ironically, France was thinking the same thing at the same time.
France, who had an ally with the Russians. So if France comes in to help the Russians fight the Japanese, then they might be able to increase their positions in China, but that would expose them in Africa to England. So what do you do?
Well, interestingly enough, in the midst of this war, France reaches out to England and suggests that they sit down and talk. Now, I have it phrased here based on a quote in one of my books that both powers shucked off an ancient rivalry.
Now, I may have said it to you guys before, and gal, England and France hated each other, and France was the historic bad guy of Europe for over 1,000 years. Every single major war that goes back to the fall of Rome, the English were always on one side, and the French were always on the other. And sometimes they fought wars against one another, like the Hundred Years' War, like the French and Indian War.
To say these two countries hated each other is an understatement. Oh, I actually have it in my notes. They fought 23 major wars against one another.
So, the fact that they were talking was in itself an extraordinary event.
But even more shocking, by the end of 1904, the diplomats announced they established what's known as a gentleman's agreement, the Entente Cordiale. The Entente Cordiale. This was not a formal alliance. This literally was like a handshake, a gentleman's agreement.
Did you ever promise to do something for a buddy? You know, you didn't form a contract. You didn't write it down. You didn't have witnesses. No, you just said, okay, I'll help you out. Shake his hand.
Well, this unprecedented agreement, an informal agreement, basically allowed both nations to say, no matter what happens, we're not going to fight one another. England is going to do England's thing in its side of the world, and France is going to do their thing on their side of the world. So, for example, this is how England was able to take over Egypt without France saying anything, even though France was taking over the rest of North Africa. France was over here doing its thing, England was over here, and even though they should have or could have fought one another, both said no. This was huge because both powers told their allies, while you're fighting in China, Russia and Japan, we're not getting involved.
Well, this resulted in another extraordinary event. Just 3 years later, due to the help of the French, who was allies with Russia, the French managed to convince England to sit down with Russia and to attempt reconciliation. So this still was an entente, an agreement, not an alliance.
Long story short, England promised to be friends to the French and Russian alliance. But England reserved the right not to get involved in any wars. So Russia, you go do your thing. France, you go do your thing, and we're going to do ours. But now you know what this means? Now the map of Europe is divided into two separate arm camps. You have the Triple Alliance, and then you have the Triple Entente. And you want to talk about a recipe for war? Well, I'll tell you this much. I was no angel when I was a young man. And in several incidents in my life resulted in fisticuffs. I didn't fight like that, by the way. Some fights I won, some fights I lost. But interestingly enough, most of the fights that I got in because I had a buddy or two standing behind me saying, do it, do it, do it.
And interestingly enough, most of the fights I lost was because the other guy had a bunch of buddies saying, do it, do it, do it.
Because truth be told, if it's just one-on-one, even if you're pissed off at somebody, it's very rare that a human being will result to blows.
Because we're most of us are rational creatures, and we have a tendency just to take a step back and be like, yeah, I don't know if I really want to do this. I don't know if it's worth it. But when you have those little voices speaking in your ears, you're more apt to do something dumb.
So, for all of these nations who are dreaming of new imperialism, social Darwinism, viewing war as a good thing, now suddenly you have this division between sides. And just think what would happen if a war broke out between Italy and France. Or if a war broke out between Germany and England. Or if a war broke out between Austria and Russia. It wouldn't just be mano a mano. It would be one side versus the other. Questions? By the way, historians tend to refer to this as the Kaiser's alliance system. Very different than Bismarck's alliance system. Oh, triple alliance versus triple entente. Let's write that down. And then we're going to do the do it. We good? Jordan, Dave, I know you guys write. Okay. Everyone else is doing work in other classes. That's okay.
Hopefully you take it in through osmosis. All right.
So, the flaws of this alliance system would be completely exposed because shortly after 1900, in the early decade of the 20th century, a bunch of crises began popping up. And interestingly enough, it usually involved one or another nation on either side of the alliances getting into it with somebody on the other side. And each time, they would get closer and closer to the brink of war. The easiest thing to do it is to divide it into two sections. So first, we'll talk about what happened between England, France, and Germany. In 1904, just after the Entente Cordiale is agreed to, a crisis would erupt in the country of Morocco, sometimes referred to as the Tangiers Crisis. This crisis occurred because of location. If you've never had geography, here's the Mediterranean, here's the Atlantic, here's Spain, a little section of North Africa that's out on the Atlantic that also stands at the mouth of the Mediterranean. That's where Morocco is. Throughout the 16th, all the way up into the early 19th century, Spain and Portugal, as they launched the Age of Exploration, continually tried to conquer Morocco. But Morocco was able to fight back because technically Morocco was part of the Ottoman Empire. But as Europe industrialized, and we talked about the Ottoman strength weakening, that made Morocco a tempting target. In the 1830s, France seized Algeria here and soon began basically saying, well, it would only be cleaner if we just take the whole chunk here too. But of course, the Moroccans were able to kind of push back. But Morocco's weakness was exposed in 1884 when a war actually erupted between Spain and Morocco, which Morocco lost, and Spain would establish a protectorate along the coast. So Morocco would basically lose its coastline. Spain claimed it was theirs to protect. Well, in 1904, France basically decides, well, we're stronger than Spain, and we don't care about the coast, but rather, we want to move inland. Spain wanted to control the Straits of Gibraltar. France wanted to control the interior. Because if they control the interior, here is their colony. This would give them control of North Africa. Now, 1904, France is emboldened because of the Entente Cordiale. Because England, who controls the Suez Canal, prior to the Entente Cordiale, would probably have a problem if France took this area from Spain. Because England and France hated one another. But now, England basically says, you do you. So they push in. But much to the surprise of England and France, out of nowhere, Germany announces it doesn't approve. Now, Germany has no claim to Morocco. Germany at this point had no colonies in Africa. But now, suddenly, out of nowhere, Germany sits back and says France should not take Morocco? Even more fascinating is the Kaiser decided to attempt a alpha dog move. In March 1905, he gets on a gunboat and sails to the port city of Tangiers. Where is he in the procession? He's back here somewhere. But he's actually being escorted to the Sultan's palace. Well, while there, he meets with the Sultan, Abdelaziz, tours the city, has many photo ops, but most importantly, he has a press conference in which he declares that Morocco should be a sovereign country. Morocco should be self-governing. And he said the Sultan is the sovereign. So all nations should respect the sovereignty of Morocco. Gets put in the newspapers. Gets printed all over the world. And of course, the first country to react was France. Oh, there he is. Look, there he is. There's the Sultan. An old, dirty picture, but sitting there shaking hands, getting along swimmingly. Well, France is furious. What right does Germany have to say that no one can take Morocco? This is the age of new imperialism. And then even worse for the French, the Sultan, Abdelaziz, tells France essentially to go pound sand. That he has no interest in allowing the French to come in. Which infuriates the French. And rumors begin circulating in Paris that France is contemplating sending in a military force. To which the Sultan blocks. When in the press, he puts forward a request for a conference, diplomacy. And again, we've already talked about a couple of conferences. The most important one for the fourth exam is the Berlin Conference. But basically, all of the nations are going to gather together and they're going to use diplomacy and they're going to figure out a diplomatic solution. Well, France initially rejects the idea of a conference. When France rejected it, Germany declared it was going to mobilize its military. That it was going to potentially go to war with France over Morocco. And France would actually move troops to the border of Morocco. We are on the cusp of a war. But then England contacts France and basically says, if you go to war over Morocco, you're on your own. And so France says, fine.
In
Algiers, which is in southern Spain, 14 nations meet to deliberate a diplomatic solution to the Moroccan crisis. Not that you need to remember this, but present was Germany, Austria, England, France, Russia, Spain, the United States, Italy, Morocco, Netherlands, Sweden, Portugal, Belgium, and the Ottoman Empire.
All of these diplomats are sitting at this nice long table, and they're sitting there talking, what should we do?
Well, the first country to make a proposal was Germany. Germany suggests we should create a condominium, which is where the condo that you may be familiar with, the term originated from. What is a condo?
Nice house, or like a smaller, how do you know how to describe it?
Well, it could be a nice house, and it is smaller.
Connected houses.
Connected houses. Who owns the outer structure?
A landlord.
Well, could be. Could be. Who owns the inner rooms? Ah, so the whole property is split between multiple people inside. That's what Germany wanted. Germany wanted joint ownership of all of Morocco, but sections of Morocco would be divided up. And Germany would get a chunk, because Germany wants colonies.
Well, the funny thing is, of the 14 nations, 12 say no, including Italy, who technically was Germany's ally. The only nation that voted with Germany was Austria. So, first proposal gets shot down. France then makes a proposal.
What if Morocco, the Sultan, still is in charge, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and the Sultan still has police powers?
But France gets control of their economy. France will create a central bank. France will print the money. Well, of the 14 nations, the overwhelming majority said, okay, this is good, no war. Technically, the Sultan's still in charge. And this is more of a business arrangement as opposed to a colonial possession.
Well, here's the thing. If I control your bank account and I control all of your money, are you free? Do you actually have control over your life? No.
Well, in the eyes of the European nations, this is a fine arrangement. It avoids war. We're proving that we're superior. And the French can help. Remember when I talked about the ideas of social Darwinism and altruism? That the Europeans have that white man's burden to help out the more primitive people? Well, France, by controlling the money, will help the Moroccans. And in this, Germany was forced to stand down.
So, basically, the Kaiser had no interest in, making Morocco soccer. It was just, a tactic.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm sure when they met, they made some type of deal. The Sultan probably said something along the lines of, look, if you keep the French out, we'll give you mineral rights. Or something like that. or will let you control like different ports. Because those are the same type of deals that were made in China. Look, technically the Chinese emperor is still in charge, but we're going to control this sphere of influence. Well, because the Kaiser had no leverage, he backed down.
But like everything, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. No matter what you do in life, there are always consequences.
And the biggest consequences of this agreement was simple.
The nation most responsible for convincing all of the other countries to basically allow France to take over the economy was England.
And this diplomatic maneuver basically showed that the Entente was strong, because this was the wink, wink, nudge, nudge that I talked about before. Once France got control of Morocco, France basically said to England, take over Egypt. Quid pro quo. Of course, the Kaiser is humiliated.
He got played. He got completely outmaneuvered.
He thought that him looking all tough and fancy, trying to prove he was the alpha dog, would allow him to get what he wanted. But in the end, he was outmaneuvered. He didn't lose the battle with fists. He lost the battle of the minds. He lost. So he was determined not going to be embarrassed again. But by far the biggest loser was the Sultan, Abdulaziz. He had, the leader of his country had no say over the fiscal policy of his country. He lost control of taxation. He lost control of spending.
Heck, the Bank of Morocco even put him on an allowance.
They basically told him how much money he could have every month. And as this guy, who was a collector of automobiles and would basically pay, in modern money, millions and millions of dollars for every type of model of automobile that was available under the sun, this was a huge blow.
Questions.
Well, fortunately, unfortunately, this wasn't the end, because nothing was settled. If anything, now it's worse. And that's the reason why, just 5 years later, another crisis would erupt in Morocco.
The second crisis is some often referred to as the Agadir crisis, and I don't have it up there. A-G-A-D-I-R. A-G-A-D-I-R. The Agadir crisis. Now, unlike the first crisis, which was because of the French, the second crisis was also like the French, but it was a consequence of the French control of the economy. 1911, the people of Morocco were pissed off, angry, and began to rebel. Now, truth be told, there were many people in Morocco that were also angry over the Sultan, the new Sultan, Abdelhaif, because the new Sultan, in the eyes of the people, allowed the French to do this. And to make matters worse, the new Sultan was a brutal dictator. So anyone who questioned him were killed, tortured. So the people, to a degree, were rising up for independence.
But
when word got out that the Sultan, who was basically the French puppet, was trapped in his palace, France would actually send in troops from Algeria, which was a violation of the Algeciras Conference. It was the Moroccans who had police power. Do you think the American people would sit back if the Canadians or the Mexicans sent in an army into our country? Well, France claimed that they weren't invading. France claimed that they weren't trying to conquer. But rather, France was just protecting its own interests. Money. It controlled the economy. But much to the surprise of the French, the Germans would deploy a gunboat to Agadir. The SMS Panther. On board was a detachment of German Marines. Now, in fairness, there were a couple of German businesses that had offices in Agadir. So Germany, in sending this show of military force, they claimed, we're not going to conquer Morocco, but we're just trying to protect our interests. Well, the Brits became so concerned at the arrival of the Germans, they actually deployed their Mediterranean fleet to basically bottle up Agadir. To prevent the Germans from taking control of the port. Now, ironically, behind the scenes, England was contacting France and telling the French to get their troops out. But France ignored it. Because the English warned the French, what happens if one of your soldiers accidentally shoots a German? It's usually how wars start. Well, ironically, when France told England to go pound sand, the Entente nearly failed. France stopped listening to England. Ironically, France would also contact Germany and try doing a little, look, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. France tells Germany, hey, look, Germany, if you allow us to take Morocco, we're not going to throw our phone behind us, but rather, we'll give you territory elsewhere in Africa. So let us take this piece, you can take somewhere else. Well, Germany didn't respond. Germany had not wanted anywhere else in Africa other than Morocco. That rhetorical one last piece of pizza in the box. Now, England apparently was hesitant. Because England sat back and said, well, that's normally how we settle deals. Look, you let me take this and I'll give you something else. Ironically, England told France that it might be willing to reconsider the condominium idea. Well, France replied, well, if you do that, no more Entente.
We are on the brink of war again. The only thing that prevented it this time was in the midst of the crisis, the German stock market would plunge 30% in a single day. And overall, the German central bank lost about one-fifth of its total capital. There was a run on the banks. Gold was being hoarded. And Germany was on the brink of a depression. FYI, you can't win wars if you fight during a depression. So, while this was going on, the Kaiser, even though he was willing to go to war this time, had to back down again. The Kaiser would recall the German Marines and would open up diplomatic channels. But even this almost failed. Because now the French felt they had leverage. When Germany told France, okay, we'll take you up on your offer. We have nothing, we don't want anything in Morocco. Give us land elsewhere. France decided it was going to play hardball. And decided not to respond. Well, that was until England got involved and basically told the French, this is the deal to take. So, on November 4th, 1911, British, French, and German diplomats would meet in Berlin and they would sign what became known as the Franco-German Accord. Very simple. France gets Morocco. Germany gets the Congo, which would become known as Nouveau Cameroun, or New Cameroon. So, France gets Morocco, Germany gets Cameroon. Now, ironically, this was a diplomatic solution and both sides got something. And at the end of the day, this is how you make deals. This is the art of the deal. You don't get everything you want. So you take what you can get and you give what you have to give to get that. But both the French people and the German people were all fired up because of nationalism. The French people were so mad that the French premier was actually forced to resign. The French people literally took to the streets. And the German press, well, under censorship laws, they really couldn't criticize the Kaiser. But most of the stories basically claim that the Kaiser got played for a fool. That Cameroon was not equal to Morocco. But again, at least war was avoided. But now we're getting closer and closer to the brink. Because there would be consequences. The French came to believe that the only way to deal with the Kaiser was through force, threats of force. England suddenly realized there is going to be a war, and it needs to build up its navy. And Germany also realized that war was possible.
So Germany needed to build up its military. Because the next time, the Kaiser was not going to back down.
So ironically, all three nations, all in their own way, basically said, the line in the sand is drawn. If we get to that point, we're going to shoot first and ask questions later.
Well, at the same time, tensions are brewing between Germany, England, and France. In Eastern Europe, tensions are also rising. In the Balkans.
And just as there were three nations that were involved in Morocco, there also were three nations trying to seize control of this region. The Balkans. You had the Austro-Hungarian Empire looking to build upon its gain of Bosnia and Herzegovina, looking to expand its influence down and in. You had Russia. Oh, go back. You had Russia dreaming of a warm water port and access to the Mediterranean, basically looking to make the Black Sea a Russian lake. And then sandwiched in the middle was Serbia. The Balkan country that wanted to unify the Balkans into a single empire. Questions? Seeing none. So let's do a recap, a little quick review. We should know that Serbia declared its independence from the Ottoman Empire in 1876. We've talked about this twice. We should know that the consequence of this was the Russo-Turkish War, which was originally settled with the Treaty of San Stefano, but England and Austria screwed the Russians over and forced them to agree to the Treaty of Berlin. But the biggest thing that came about for the Treaty of Berlin, not only did Bulgaria have to stay within the empire, not only did Russia not get access to the Turkish Straits, but Serbia, its independence would be recognized, but if you recall, it's not going to get Bosnia. Bosnia had been traditionally part of Serbia, but the Serbs weren't getting it. Austria was. So this is the This is the ink in the eye.
Who's going to control the Balkans? Well, Austria thinks it should get it. Russia thinks it should get it. And Serbia thinks it should get it.
Fast forward.
During the second incarnation of the Three Emperors League, when Tsar Alexander II
Tsar Alexander III rejoined after the death of his father, Tsar Alexander II. At some point, there was discussions that, yeah, it makes sense. So now, Austria technically is occupying Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Ottoman Empire is down here. It has no way to get to Bosnia-Herzegovina. Why don't we let Austria take it? But unfortunately, Tsar Alexander III died of a heart attack during the discussions, and his son, Nicholas II, would reject the idea. Because Nicholas wanted control of the Balkans. And ultimately, this would cause the Three Emperors League to die a final time. Nicholas's motivation is sometimes referred to as Pan-Slavism. Russians, Slavic in nature, wanted to unify with the Slavic peoples of the Balkans because they practiced the same Orthodox religion and they had the same cultural tradition. Questions. So now, let's start the 20th century. The first in the series of dominoes that would make tensions in the Balkans explode, ironically, was an assassination. In May of 1903, in Serbia, there was a coup d'etat in which the king, Alexander, and his wife, Draga, were actually assassinated in the palace. In addition to the death of the king and the queen, was the prime minister, the head of the army, and the top general. Now, truth be told, Alexander was not a nice guy. He was a brutal tyrant. He frequently killed political opponents. He, in particular, enjoyed seeing people who opposed him politically thrown off roofs and watching them go splat. Cruel guy. So, when this occurred, this was basically an uprising. But the people involved, the revolutionaries, was a secret society called the Black Hand. The Black Hand was made up of middle and junior officers in the army. So we're not talking the generals. But we're talking like the captains and lieutenants and the colonels. This group was a nationalist group. It was the Black Hand that wanted to create a pan-Serbian empire. And of course, they were inspired by what Bismarck did in Prussia. Using war for political gains. Because the king and the queen had no heir, the Black Hand would put one of the king's cousins, Peter, on the throne. And this was a huge political shift. Because Alexander was pro-German, pro-Austrian, whereas Peter was pro-Russian. By 1903, everybody knew about the dual alliance between France and Russia, and Peter wanted to get in on it. And shortly after he took to the throne, he contacts France, contacts Russia, and essentially revisits the Bosnia idea that had lain dormant for almost 30 years. The king's advisors basically said, look, Why does the Austrians control Slavic people? Lands that are traditionally ours. We should get them back. To which Nicholas agreed. But unfortunately, the timing was awful.
1903-1904, Russia is engaged in a war with Japan.
And as we know, in 1905, Russia essentially would be defeated.
As we're going to see when we get to the Russian Revolution, in 1905, there was a precursor on a revolution attempt.
So Russia lost a war and its people are uprising at home. Now's not the time to risk a war with Austria over Bosnia. So, the Tsar's government sends word to Peter, we're not going to war with Austria so you can get Bosnia. Well, this infuriates the Serbs.
But like I said at the beginning of the class, it's very rare that someone's going to willing to get into a fight on their own. So instead of pushing it, Serbia stands down.
But tensions would continue to escalate.
So much so, in 1906, a war erupted known as the Pig War.
Which I am being serious, it was actually called the Pig War. The Pig War was not a military war. Rather, it was an economic war that took place between Austria and Serbia. Serbia was economically dependent upon Austria and had been so for many years. Its primary export was pork and other livestock. So basically Serbia, most of the Serbian economy involved raising animals for slaughter. Well, 90% of Serbia's exports went to Austria. And Austria sent to Serbia roughly 60% of Serbian imports. So long story short, while Austria is not controlling the bank like in Morocco, if 90% of your pay comes from one source and 60% of your goods, they effectively have control over you. Well, with the emergence of King Peter's regime,
the government basically says, look, having all of our money invested with one country, it's not a good idea. Because Austria control our economy by controlling sales.
So Serbia decides, hey, let's look if we can find some new trading partners. Let's expand our economy. So between 1904 and 1905, Serbia makes trade agreements with Greece, with the Ottoman Empire, with Egypt, Bulgaria, France, even Germany. So now all of those countries are going to be able to buy Serbian pork and Serbian livestock in exchange for Serbia being able to buy goods from those countries.
Well, the problem is if I don't control you economically, I don't control you anymore. And if you can go out and make new relationships, you could become stronger. And thus a threat. So Austria decides to attempt to cause a complete depression in Serbia to make it back down.
Serbia cuts off all exports to Serbia. And considering, prior to all the trade agreements, 60% of the stuff that came into Serbia came from Austria, this would be crippling. But unfortunately for the Austrians,
there were other people that wanted to do business with Serbia. So Serbia starts getting help.
France in particular invest millions of dollars in Serbia and gives to the Serbs revolutionary technology. Meat packing factories. Prior to this, when Serbia exported meat, it had to be stayed refrigerated, or the animals had to be alive. But with having the ability to pack the meat, you're cutting it, you're prepping it, you're putting it in cans, which means it has a longer life, shelf life, which means now you can start sending it further abroad, which was huge because by 1905, the Serbian economy begins going through the roof.
And to make matters even more interesting, Russia declares that it wants to make a trade agreement with Serbia.
But then Austria tells Russia, if you stick your nose in the Balkans, we're going to consider that an act of war. Russia doesn't have the right, under all the previous agreements, to interfere in diplomatic relations in the Balkans. So now we have another crisis brewing. Russia's trying to put its hand into the cookie jar, and Austria's smacking it away. Now, Russia then goes and makes the dunderhead move, pledging that it would support Serbia if a war actually broke out. Military war. But much to the shock of Nikki, his cousin, Willie, intervenes.
Germany tells the Tsar's government,
if a war erupts between Austria and Serbia and Russia intervenes, Germany will attack Russia. Well, 1905, 1906, Russia's not any stronger than it was in 1905. So once again, it's forced to back down. Twice in the span of 2 years, Serbia's looking for Russians' help. Russia says, I'm going to help. And then suddenly does one of these. You know. Now, military conflict was avoided because in 1909, Austria and Serbia would make a new trade agreement. Austria would cut its tariffs, and Serbia promised to buy more Austrian goods. But again, tensions were getting close to the brink. All right, and I don't have time to talk about what's next.
So, to those who came late, which was a good chunk of you, quarter past 12, just saying, set your watches. I screwed up on the engage. You should have had your exam grades viewable. There's still two people who haven't taken the exam, but I thought I opened up your exam grades, and I screwed it up because I was told you can't see it. So as soon as I get home, actually, it might not be tonight. I got a busy night. So I'll be home tomorrow. First thing in the morning, I'll see what I did wrong, and hopefully you'll be able to view your grades tomorrow. All right? Papers, papers, papers. Don't forget papers are due. That's coming up as well. So talk to you soon.